I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of November. The first all things political after the election, although we spent Wednesday and Thursday of last week doing all things political kinds of shows discussing the results of the election. Since then, President-elect Donald Trump has announced some key White House posts. At least one is getting a lot of attention today and criticism. Steve Bannon from Breitbart News, a highly controversial appointment. We have seen demonstrations in many American cities over the last few days. Analysts are trying to figure out what Donald Trump will do about the issues that were front and center during the campaign. The wall, Supreme Court appointments, climate change, immigration. And the Democrats are trying to figure out what happened to the party, who they will have as head of the DNC, how they were so out of touch with particularly blue-collar workers in the Midwest, actually. Our guest this hour has written about political leadership and the press being a little too eager to regard any of this as normal. Jamil Smith says many of us will face real threats. Many are already facing them. Everything from legal abortion to press freedoms will be challenged, already have been. And those of us, he writes, opposed to Trump's autocratic regressive agenda will resist them. We will, over the course of these many months ahead of us, be hearing from many points of view. It will be hard because almost half the country will not like hearing a certain point of view. The other half of the country will not like hearing a certain point of view. And I can only hope that we will be able to listen to each other because we'll hear some very different perspectives in the months ahead. Our phone number for you to speak with Jamil, and Jamil, let me tell you about him, is a senior national correspondent for MTV News. He also hosts a digital series on politics called The Racket. He was a senior editor at The New Republic and also was a producer for MSNBC's Melissa Harris Perry and The Rachel Maddow Show. He is a proud Midwesterner who now lives on the East Coast. He is from Cleveland, and he will be with us for this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, our Facebook page, where we love to hear your messages and like to read them. It's a good way for us to be in touch with each other, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Jamil Smith, hello. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote just recently about the threats that University of Pennsylvania African-American students were facing in the last couple days. And you also write about you being a black freshman at Penn in 1993 when you received racist threats. It's brought up some very bad memories for you.
Yes, indeed. Well, here's the thing, is that it brings up memories not just of the incident, you know, this phone call late at night. We're studying for midterms in our first semester, and a guy calls and says, you know, is this the N-word dorm? Basically the dorm that I lived in, the W.B. Du Bois College House, was primarily an African-American studies college house, which meant primarily African-American students in it. So it became a bit of a target for racial harassment. And so we just not only remember what happened back then when we see about the story that's happening now, but we also remember how we responded to it. We responded to it with strength, with fortitude, and with determination. We hope that the students at Penn now are doing the same.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what appears to have happened last week. And let's look at Wisconsin for a moment. The Rust Belt was important in this whole election. Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote a really interesting piece, how Donald Trump became the first Republican in 32 years, which is significant, to win Wisconsin. He was more disliked than Clinton, far less popular than Barack Obama. He lost the April GOP primary to Ted Cruz by a large percentage point. He underperformed in the state's biggest counties, but there was a seismic shift in the blue-collar vote, especially in rural Wisconsin. And that happened in Pennsylvania. That happened in Michigan. It happened certainly in Ohio. What was going on there?
Well, I mean, what we see there, I think, are a number of factors. Number one, a bit of a lack of attention to this region from the Clinton campaign. Of course, we can't underscore the power of seeing a politician in person, shaking hands, holding rallies, and getting to know the voters that he or she is trying to appeal to. But that said, there are a lot of cultural factors here that I think we're swinging this. When you see people, a lot of people swing from Obama to Trump, which seems like an odd calculation given the differences in policy and differences in temperament, differences in qualification, quite frankly. when you see people making those switches, you can't ignore the identity-based factors, some of which are sexism, some of which are racism, some of which are, frankly, a backlash against this, you know, progressively more brown, more open, more tolerant America. And a lot of people, you know, frankly, would like to have a scapegoat. And we see in some of the comments we've been seeing from Trump voters, you know, from the Midwest and throughout the country, a desire to make sure that someone paid for the situation that they find themselves in, whether it's, you know, bad economic situation or bad jobs, what have you. And we just cannot trace, you know, these we cannot trace anything, you know, that they're talking about to anything that Barack Obama has done, that Hillary Clinton has proposed, and it's just simply an emotional thing. So that's the thing about politics. You can't necessarily calculate it. We can't necessarily put everything into a box. We have to account for the emotion that is involved when people step into the booth.
Yeah. So let's take in that factor of sexism, racism, xenophobia. You wrote recently, Jamil, "I will not be surprised if the need to govern all of us alienates his base, and I will not be surprised if being president of a huge multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy turns many of his supporters against him as a traitor to their values." Do we have any sense of how many Americans hold those kinds of views?
Well, I mean, I think certainly one thing we can take from this is a lot more than we used to think. I mean, certainly in areas where we grew up, in Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan, there are people, it's not necessarily people who are out, you know, saying, "Hey, I'm going to go to the voting booth and I'm going to make sure I vote to regress social norms, and I'm going to make sure that I vote for racism, I vote for sexism." It's not about necessarily voting for cultural bias. It's about, like, not basically taking that enough into account when you place your vote, saying that my pain or my situation outweighs these concerns that, you know, a lot of Muslims, a lot of immigrants, a lot of black people, a lot of women are facing today. As we've seen in just the last week, there's been a spike in harassment and intimidation. More than 200 incidents have been reported to the Southern Poverty Law Center of this kind of, you know, hateful reaction by Trump supporters to Trump's win. So this is the kind of sign that we're fearing, frankly, would, you know, this open freedom to express these hateful emotions, these hateful thoughts. This is the kind of thing we've kind of opened the door to now that Trump has been elected.
You also, and there's been a lot of concern today about his appointment as a senior counselor of Steve Cannon from Breitbart, Stephen Bannon, the head of Breitbart, and his campaign manager. And it is troublesome when you look at the stories that Breitbart has been featuring over the past year or so. Some of them are just, I mean, let me read some of these. "Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer? Hoisted high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage. Gabby Giffords, the gun control movement's human shield." I mean, some of those, and he is in a position of prominence. Can you tell me, why do you think the president-elect would appoint this man? He obviously was helpful, perhaps, in getting him elected, but appoint him to such a prominent position.
Well, number one is, I believe that Steve Bannon echoes a lot of what Donald Trump believes. You don't appoint someone to be your chief strategist at the White House, you know, basically your Karl Rove, if you don't want that person feeding you what you feel like is wisdom. And, to you know, the wisdom that Steve Bannon will be imparting to Donald Trump as president will be this doctrine of what is known as the alt-right. Now, let's keep in mind, that's a brand name for white nationalism, this rebranding of this nativist push for white identity to be, you know, more privileged than it already is. It's, you know, basically a way to attack through policy, through rhetoric, through cultural attacks and what have you, this, you know, idea that multiculturalism in America can work. They don't believe it can. They believe political correctness is essentially the great Satan. They believe that social justice is not worth our time. It's essentially a strike against whiteness. This is a really interesting way that whiteness has come to become, you know, has become a, you know, real political identity in our elections. But certainly, we don't want to necessarily have it happen this way. Let's be frank. I mean, this is a guy who is accused of being an anti-Semite by his ex-wife in divorce filings. We have a history of him making derogatory comments about women. We have history of him, you know, abusing women. And this is somebody who's going to be a step away from the Oval Office. It's a frightening, frightening prospect, and it should not be underplayed.
What do you make of progressive Democrats, people like Bernie Sanders, people like Elizabeth Warren, people like Robert Reich, who've been writing recently, we can get behind this guy if he is going to create jobs, if he is going to address the very angst that we were hearing from people who voted for us or who supported our wing of the Democratic Party? We will not tolerate racism or sexism or xenophobia, and we will fight that and call it out at every step of the way. But we can work with this administration on getting jobs, building an infrastructure, getting people back to work, helping people lift their lives up in some way. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Well, there's two sides to this coin. Number one is, of course, we hope that President-elect Trump is a success. We hope that he does not, frankly, do too much damage. That's essentially the limit of my hope with regards to his administration, that he does not do too much damage to our democracy, that he does not do too much damage to the programs that President Obama has instituted that are working, does not do too much damage to women's rights, to gay rights, to African-American rights, all these different civil rights that we've worked so hard to institute. We hope that he does not do away with them. That's number one. Number two is, I fear what Senator Sanders is getting at is the same thing that tripped him up during the primary, which is this centering of the white working class and, you know, over, frankly, the black working class and other working classes of color that are doing worse than the white working class. you know, one of the things that he said, I come from the white working class. I feel deeply humiliated that the Democratic Party cannot talk to the people that I came from. He's from Flatbush here in Brooklyn. Okay, let's make it clear. He is not from Wisconsin. He is not from West Virginia. He is not from Ohio. He is not from the Rust Belt. Okay, there are a lot of Democrats who are from the Rust Belt who have been talking to these constituents and have been imparting the successes of the Democratic platform and also what could have been in store. I frankly don't understand what he's talking about. So I think what we're seeing here is Senator Sanders sort of relying on these old talking points that helped him achieve, you know, a lot of prominence during the campaign. It's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking that I feel like really isn't all that helpful.
Yeah. And what happened with the Hillary Clinton campaign, Jamil?
Well, I think that, one, they made the mistake of believing the polls. A lot of us did. And I think that what they did, I think they maybe had unfortunately made an overestimation in how far we've come and how little appeal white resentment has for, you know, in a national election. White resentment certainly has a lot of appeal in local elections and state elections, particularly where, you know, precincts are gerrymandered to, you know, benefit Republicans in Republican-controlled states. But in national elections, we, you know, there was a lot of hype, a lot of talk about this firewall of people of color, of women, and frankly, one of those came through for her. People of color voted in droves for Hillary Clinton. And yet, black women voted in droves for Hillary Clinton. Hispanic women droves for Hillary Clinton. White women did not. White women voted 10 points for Trump. And so what we're seeing there is the you know, how white identity, frankly, trumps gender. And I think that the Hillary Clinton campaign may not have anticipated just how much that would happen.
Yeah. Didn't you also, though, have, this was true in Wisconsin, that the Democrats in the city of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee just didn't do very well at all. In Dane County, huge numbers, record numbers of Democrats voted for Hillary Clinton, and it was historic, more than voted for LBJ, huge numbers. But when you looked at Milwaukee, which is predominantly African-American, the numbers were way off, like 25, 26,000 fewer voters. What is that? Well, what was that all about?
Well, I think, I mean, the Milwaukee elections chief was right on top of it when he saw there's a decline of about 41,000 voters in Milwaukee, right? He's saying that the voter ID requirements in the state played a big part in the lack of turnout and people being either turned away from the polls for lack of ID. There were reports out of Wisconsin where people had the proper ID yet were still turned away. And frankly, the mere requirement of having this ID, you know, it may sound like something that is easy to get. Oh, what's the big problem? It's just a driver's license. It's just a state ID. Well, a lot of people don't have birth certificates, so they can't get these state IDs, or they don't have the time or the wherewithal to get the, you know, paperwork done to get all this stuff. All that said, you know, the essential question keeps not being asked, which is, why do you have to have a voter ID in the first place? What are you trying to prevent? They say they're trying to prevent voter fraud. Voter fraud is infinitesimally small, about 31 cases out of a billion, according to a study that happened during the campaign. And so this is not a real problem. Yet we have all these state laws that purport to solve that problem, while at the same time causing more of them. So we, yes, you know, there may have been people in Milwaukee throughout Wisconsin that did not show up to vote when they should have. But we cannot discount the effect that a voter ID law has on turnout.
Let's, before we go to phone calls, and we have a full bank of phone lines ringing at the moment, and we'll send them your way in just a moment. I'd like to talk, because you're a member of the press, about the role of the press from here onward. You talked about a little bit of concern that the press is trying to make some of this seem normal right now, when really we've seen this tremendous upheaval. There also have been problems with, during the campaign, Donald Trump not allowing journalists to accompany him on his plane as he campaigned around the country. He kicked the press out of certain kinds of events. There is concern as to whether or not he'll let a press pool go with him now as he is president-elect, and whether or not the press will have free and open access to him when he becomes president. Is that a concern of yours, or do you think that he will realize that it's important? It's an important part of an American democracy to have a free press.
Oh, it's an extraordinary concern of mine, given how Donald Trump has treated the press, given how Donald Trump has bullied the press. Let's be frank. Calling reporters out by name from a rally stage, alleging that they are somehow misinterpreting the facts of the election, when in fact they were getting the facts right and he's lying. And when you have, you know, the Republican National Convention in my hometown of Cleveland, I was on the floor while people began chanting, "Shame, shame, shame!" at the press box, and I'm standing there, and I asked the guy. I said, "You know, do you want to direct that to my face? I mean, I'm standing right here. I have a press pass." And all of a sudden, you know, he didn't have quite so much courage. I just think that, you know, we see a lot of this, like, really misbegotten groupthink that is, you know, fueling the Donald Trump, you know, experience, this extravaganza, this reality show of a campaign that he ran. I think when you start talking about carrying that into the White House, it becomes extraordinarily dangerous. All this talk we just had about emails with Hillary Clinton and about a lack of disclosure and too much secrecy, that's going to be put on steroids in a Trump White House. You know that you do not have to actually have a White House press corps. It is just tradition. A lot of these things that we count on as part of our democracy are just traditions that we uphold, that we value. And really, Donald Trump has shown very little interest in upholding any of those traditions. So we really don't know what he's going to do, but I'm frankly fearful for not only the legitimacy of the press going forward and how we're able to do our jobs, but also, frankly, the physical safety of reporters as they travel throughout this country trying to talk to these voters who have been taught to view them as the enemy.
Jamil Smith is our guest for All Things Political today, senior national correspondent for MTV News. He hosts a digital series on politics, The Racket. He was a senior editor at The New Republic and also a producer earlier for MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry and The Rachel Maddow Show. Our phone number, lines are filled right now. Just keep the number in your head and you'll be able to join us as soon as you can. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, to phone calls. And we start with Carol in Green Bay. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Kathleen. Boy, I'm always the first, right? hello, guest.
Hello. How do you do?
I am absolutely sickened and frightened. And I have to tell you, though, that I saw, this is news footage from a Trump rally some months ago, and it was a guy who was probably in his 70s, and he said, Trump is going to make it so that things will be just like they were when I was growing up. And I thought, oh, my goodness, that's where they're, you know, that's where a lot of people were at. I think that guy really spoke well to it, you know, why people went for Trump. And I wish I could see something good in this, and I just cannot. And I think Trump is going to fail. I mean, of course he's going to fail, but he doesn't even know what he's getting into. I think the weight is not even of this whole thing hasn't even sunk in on him. And I just make it now so the clock is running and we've got 4+ years and it'll just be over.
Thanks, Carol. Jamil.
Yes. I don't know if everyone saw the recent report in Wall Street Journal that detailed the first meeting that Donald Trump had with President Obama last week. And it seems that he did not realize that you have to hire an entire new West Wing, and that there's a lot of details about the presidency he just didn't seem to know, which is incredible to me. And it just, frankly, it's a real indignity, I think, for President Obama to literally have to spend extra time in his final days as president training his unqualified white male replacement. I think that a lot of women and a lot of people of color understand what that is like.
I think he was surprised. A lot of people have said, you could see it in his face. You could see it in his 60 Minutes interview last night, that everybody seemed pretty surprised that he won this thing.
Yeah, and yeah, it's clear that he did not expect to win. It's clear his people did not expect him to win, which I think, frankly, people who voted for him should take that into account. he basically underestimated them. And he underestimated their voting power. That said, we cannot leave out in this conversation, like I was saying before, the power of voter suppression and, you know, these voter restrictions, voter ID laws, cutting and early voting hours, all these different things that happened. North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, these states where they have these laws, it mattered in the result.
Thanks, Carol, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
I want to go back to the Scott Walker demonstrations. I'm a union person who demonstrated against Walker here in Milwaukee. We went way overboard in our hate and our anger, and we turned off people that were probably on the fence and hadn't decided yet were they for the left or the right in the Scott Walker campaign. And in all of our anger, in all of our demonstrations, I'm not against demonstrating, but we shouldn't be turning off the people that are undecided. And maybe what's going on now in the country as these demonstrations are getting violent, we can take a note from Nelson Mandela, from Martin Luther King, from Gandhi, and maybe start a letter-writing campaign from grade school kids across this country, Spanish kids, Muslim kids, black kids here in the city of Milwaukee. The city of Milwaukee is the worst place in the nation.
All right, what's a letter-writing campaign, Ray? What kind of campaign?
The children could explain what it's like to live in their neighborhoods and ask this man, anybody can be transformed. You can take a murderer out of prison, and if he's treated in a certain way, he will not be a murderer when he's released. This man, Donald Trump, can be transformed. But if we try to transform him with hate and anger and conceit and arrogance, we're acting exactly the way we say he has been acting.
All right. Thanks, Ray. What do you make of that, Jamil?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly any form of protest, I think, is good. I'm not going to be on discouraging anybody from figuring out a way to access power in their own way, whether it's kids writing letters, whether it's people marching in the streets, whether it's you know, people running for office. I think people running for office has become, you know, a way for people to protest, because if, like, look, if you're not hearing, if you're not getting your voice heard by these people who keep getting elected, then run yourself. I think that that's something that, especially with young people, we are trying to encourage. But as far as the protests with regards to Scott Walker, I think that he makes an interesting point, which, you know, maybe certainly the intensity of these protests maybe hurt, you know, the feelings or turn some people off. But at the same time, if they turn those folks off, how dedicated are they then to liberal principles? How dedicated are they to, you know, multiculturalism? How dedicated are they to all these different things that are, you know, certainly became more and more important under Obama administration and, you know, were represented in, you know, in theory by the Clinton campaign? How important are these things to these people if, in fact, you see a protest that, you know, maybe, oh, that's just a little bit too intense for me, and that leads me to vote for an unqualified demagogue who doesn't know what job he's about to take. I just think that's a bit, like, let's not normalize this. They didn't vote for Paul Ryan here. They didn't vote for, you know, Mitt Romney here. They voted for a guy who doesn't know what he's doing and has a history of racism and sexism and, frankly, bragging about sexual assault. This is not normal.
Ray, thanks for the call. Joanne has, speaking of Ryan, brings up Ryan in a Facebook comment. I'm more than dismayed by Paul Ryan's see no evil response to the appointment of Steve Bannon as chief strategist. Paul Ryan knows that Mr. Bannon is a white supremacist, but pretends to not know anything about him, saying, I've never met the guy, Ryan said on CNN's State of the Union. I don't know Steve Bannon, so I have no concerns. I trust Donald's judgment. I think he will pick who will serve him. And we will work, and we'll work well. I'm sure we will work well with whomever his chief of staff is. Well, it turns out to be his friend, so I'm sure that part is okay.
Yeah, you'll have no problem working with Reince Priebus,
right.
That's for sure.
Right. I want to ask you this. It is a theme of this hour, but I'm trying to understand all of this. You wrote an interesting, well, you've written a lot about this, but you write about the fact that... let me see exactly. This is before the election, actually. You say, Jamil, we've reached that moment in our presidential race with people who look like me, meaning you, African-American male, expected to have compassion for an electorate that plans to vote for white supremacy on election day. And then you also wrote about waking up hearing about the fire of the Missionary Baptist Church in Greenville, Mississippi, and the fact that that passed from the headlines pretty quickly, you know, that you've got that kind of background. I mean, that's, and so how do you do this? How are you expected, and do you, does everybody have to have compassion for everybody else here for us to, I don't know, move into something new?
Here's what I think. I think there's a difference between understanding and compassion. I have a deep desire as a journalist to learn and to understand everyone. I want to hear stories from every walk of life. I want to understand exactly what motivations drive someone to, say, vote for Donald Trump. I think that's still compelling. What I do not have to have, and what I do not feel should be required of us as a public, is having compassion for people who are voting for my subjugation, voting for my destruction, voting for the subjugation of, like, all kinds of different marginalized peoples who Donald Trump demonized throughout his campaign and also proposed policy to then later demonize and injure. So I think what we have to do is separate this idea that we need to have compassion from this idea that we need to understand. We need to understand, certainly, why all these people did this, why all these people feel like Donald Trump is the most, you know, capable leader, and why do they want this guy to be president? That's worth understanding. What I think we got a little bit too much wrapped into, and I'm pointing at my fellow members of the press, I think we get a little bit too much wrapped into this whole idea of Trump supporters, I can't understand why they're doing this, so I need to, like, make, 50 different profiles about why, these folks in coal country are doing this, and have empathy for their plight as they vote for a person who is going to, embolden white supremacy. Hmm. I think that the words white supremacy got a little bit left behind when it comes to, his campaign, and I think that's frankly... lead to his victory.
Mm. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Good afternoon. Obviously, many are shocked, and I think many of his supporters are surprised as well, but I want to offer a little piece of hope here. I've done some number crunching, and maybe you know this, Kathleen, but Trump won this election with fewer votes, 500,000 fewer votes than Romney received as the loser in 2012, mm-hmm. and just about the same as McCain received as the loser in 2008, all right? This time around, there were close to 7 million fewer overall Democratic and Republican votes and about compared with 2012, and 10 million fewer than 2008. If we assume his 59 million votes, which was the same as McCain, about the same as Romney, if we assume many of them were similar voters to last time, that means of that big total that didn't show up this time, the 7 million compared with the last time and 10 million compared with Obama's first election, That means we didn't show up. Democrats and whatever whoever independents right. sort of slide back and forth, they didn't show up this time. So the lesson is, as always, you got to show up. This may be a call more for Frank's show tomorrow, but yes, we put him there in that we didn't show up to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same number of votes as previously.
And do you worry, Jeff, as Jamil does, about voter ID, voter restrictions being part of the reason that that happened?
I don't know. You know, obviously, I don't have I do worry about it. But let me say this as well. In Wisconsin, I looked at it, and nothing against third-party voting, and some of my best friends loved Jill Stein's approach. If you take Jill Stein's numbers, just those 30-plus thousand, and add them to Hillary Clinton's, then Hillary would have won Wisconsin by 0.1%, and the same thing would have happened in Michigan. Jill Stein's votes go to Hillary, it would have been 1%, a Clinton win. Now, that's 26 electoral votes between the two. It wouldn't have gotten her over the limit. I don't know if there's another state like that. Perhaps there is, but those few votes on the far left, most of them. Again, I understand third party voting, but we really have to think about what it gives us, what it ends up with. I don't know if it was suppression so much as people just not coming and people voting because they didn't like the Democratic candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Jeff, very much. Jamil?
Yes, I think you make some really solid points. Certainly, third-party voting this year offered some very strange choices, I felt like. You had Gary Johnson, who was ostensibly a Republican. He had been a Republican governor of New Mexico. And then you had Jill Stein, who had some, you know, definitely far-left views, but also had some controversial opinions about, say, vaccines and other things that were quite alarming, to be frank. And so the false equivalence, I think, that, you know, certainly Johnson and Stein employed in their campaigns between, you know, equivocating Clinton and Trump, I think was certainly damaging to the electorate. And I certainly think that, you know, they ended up getting a lot more votes because of that. That said, I'm not really willing to lay the election's blame at their feet. Nor am I willing to lay the blame for the election at the feet of Democratic voters who did not show up. Sure, they should have shown up, but a lot of factors are involved. Let's put the blame for this where it belongs, and that's on Trump voters.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Let's go to Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. When Trump was campaigning in the Rust Belt, he promised those people there that he would bring back the manufacturing jobs. Well, about 88 to 90% of those jobs that have left have been due to automation, and only about 10% have gone overseas. So that was pie in the sky. So what's going to happen when those manufacturing jobs like that don't come back? Now, I'll take my answer off the
air. Thanks, Eugene.
Thank you, Gene, for that. I think it's an excellent question, and I certainly think it's one Trump should have been pressed on a little bit harder during the campaign. Exactly what is he going to do when you're not able to magically revive, say, the steel industry in Pennsylvania and Ohio? How are you going to do that exactly? How are you going to navigate that? And I think the way he navigates that is continuing to press those cultural buttons, continuing to make people reminisce about this America that they have in their minds, of this America in the past that, you know, afforded, you know, frankly, white men more privilege maybe than they have now, which is to say quite a bit. And I think that, you know, this idea of an America that's this halcyon, wonderful, ideal place, it just certainly wasn't that way for my forebears growing up. It certainly wasn't that way for a lot of women, you know, coming up. And I think that, you know, too often when we hear this make America great again, we don't dissect it enough. You know, it's also make America white again, make America male again. And it's just, I mean, I don't think we're really, you know, frankly, going to see exactly how much, you know, damage it's going to do until we get through these 4 years.
Yeah. Well, and if he wanted to, at least for the moment, put some of that in the background, he would make sure. He talked a little bit about this on 60 Minutes last night. But
yeah,
the whole idea of people not being able to make enough money to send their kids to college, the amount of money you need to have a middle class life now. He talked a little bit about rebuilding infrastructure. If he put together one solid program and hammered on this and really found ways, and I don't know how he would do it, to get people jobs that paid well, some of those other issues I think would go to the back burner. Not that they should, but this is an issue that got him elected in many ways, I think. He needs to act on it.
Yeah, and say pie in the sky. He proposes a, you know, coast-to-coast railroad. Okay, that would create a lot of jobs, certainly in the Midwest, you know, the Rocky Mountain region. How is he going to pay for it? You know, he's going to, his tax plan doesn't raise taxes on the most, you know, on the wealthiest folks, and also hurts the middle class. So you're actually, you may be making more, you know, on this, you know, you may be having a job, great, you're working in this infrastructure, great, everything's working out, but you're getting taxed more. The rich are getting taxed less than they were under Obama. And so how exactly does that add up? I mean, every single economist that has any kind of good reputation, you know, thought that Trump's tax plan was a joke. And the idea that, you know, that plan that he has, you know, that's going to help these kids, you know, these kids go to college all of a sudden magically, the idea that that's better than Hillary Clinton's free college plan, the one that had been bolstered by Bernie Sanders' ideas, I just simply don't understand.
Let's go to Christine next in Franklin. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Hi.
I am one of those people that was turned away at the polls. I didn't have my driver's license with me. I thought I did. But I had a purse full of ID, a lot of, you know, credit cards. I had mail, even mail that showed I was receiving mail from, it was a disability, since 2008.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I had a charge card to Sam's Club with Discover that actually had my picture on it. And they would not take any of it.
And it was too hard for you to go home and get your forgotten ID, or what happened there?
I actually did something dumb. I was looking in my purse for my charge card, and I thought with all these ID, I could be able to vote and the right way. But I walked with a walker, mm-hmm. and I have had both my hips replaced. Yeah. I was supposed to have my knee replaced. I have my shoulder replaced.
Oh, my gosh, Christine, yeah.
Every yeah. part of my body had needed surgery on. And right. for me to go home, it was a large polling area at a sports complex. And you had right. to go to the far end of the building.
Yeah, it was too hard to do that. Well, it certainly is a fact that it's harder for people to vote now with voter ID. It's just harder. It used to be pretty right. easy. It's not anymore.
It's literally a law that makes it harder for people to vote. And in cases like this, you see that it doesn't just discriminate against people who are low income or people who are, you know, one particular race. It discriminates also against people who are not fully able. Okay? People who have trouble getting around and, you know, and have to, you know, to overcome these obstacles just to get from A to B. And so all this to solve a non-existent problem, frankly, is just un-American. The idea that you would take our most valued franchise and somehow make it harder to access is absolutely disgraceful.
Hmm. Could you, I know we're looking, we have our hands full dealing with what's going on in America, but it is interesting to listen to world response to this election. The New York Times had, I think it was the New York Times, I don't know where it was, transition to power, some of the most, it was the Times, most prominent voices will be those of advisors, oh, that's a different one, Marie Le Pen, they quote, head of France's far-right National Front, who saw a great movement across the world to upend the status quo, the Netherlands right wing, and a historic election. Britain's Nigel Farage, who came to the States and had his picture taken in the gold elevator with Donald Trump. UK Independence Party couldn't be happier. Germany's Alternative for Russia, Austria's Freedom Party, greeted warmly in Russia. What do you make of the global, from the far right, response with congratulations to Donald Trump and the admonition from Angela Merkel that we need to remember in this country values democracy, freedom, the respect for law, and the dignity of human beings?
I think it's absolutely alarming. I mean, Le Pen is one of, frankly, the more frightening world figures on the stage. She wants to become the French president. She is virulently anti-immigration, and I think you're seeing a lot of this mindset sweep across Europe and throughout the world, frankly, as the Syrian refugee crisis continues. And as you study that crisis, you see that you know, frankly, you have a lot of religious refugees, a lot of Christians, a lot of people who would normally, you know, would think that they'd fit right into a society that's dominated, you know, by Catholics or Christians, and yet skin color, national origin always come into play. And so this idea of this purity in England, we're seeing it in England, we're seeing it in France, and we're seeing it throughout Europe, Greece as well. This idea of this sort of like this white purity is a notion that, frankly, Donald Trump signs on to. These are his kind of people. And so that's the kind of mindset he's going to bring to the Oval Office. And it's absolutely frightening to think that he might be in league with actors on the world stage like this.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Jamil Smith is our guest. He is our All Things Political guest for this Monday. And he is taking phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Jamil is senior national correspondent for MTV News, and he was a senior editor at The New Republic, also a producer for MSNBC's Melissa Harris Perry and The Rachel Maddow Show. More phone calls from you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lisa on Facebook writes this, the folks in the middle who are hardworking and taxpaying backbone of this country see that their future financial prospects look bleak. I think Trump voters were voting for economic change. They were desperate enough to gamble on a president who's deeply flawed, just trying to get representation and the prospect of good paying jobs for themselves and their children.
I hope it works out for them. I mean, I don't say that with any kind of denigration. I really do hope it works out for them. I genuinely do not wish these people ill. But at the same time, while they're considering that, you know, in this desperation, which, frankly, I mean, we have an improving economy. People are making more than they have, I mean, in years. And, yes, I understand that it hasn't reached every, facet of American life. But let's think about the fact that, you know, the black working class and other working classes of color are not doing as well as the white working class. And yet they're voting overwhelmingly for the Democratic agenda. They understand that it's not worth it to have, you know, their personhood challenged, or questioned, or their legitimacy questioned at every turn to do well in this society. I mean, and frankly, Republican economic policies have been proven not to work. So I genuinely hope it works out for them, but I don't anticipate that it will.
Rod in Weyerhaeuser, hi.
Yes, thank you.
Kathleen, yeah, go ahead.
Kathleen, yeah. No, I just wanted to put my two cents always. You know, I don't trust this man one bit. You know, we're Polish background, and, you know, I grew up listening to what happened in Poland when Germany walked right through Poland twice, World War One and World War Two, because they were led by a blasphemer, and that's what I feel this man is. And, you know, it's how many of the working people, you know, I've gone to different churches just for the heck, you know, of it.
Right.
And they said that, you know, the devil's been at this a long time, and he speaks with forked tongue and gets people when they're at their weakest moment. You know, as soon as it was counted and they said that he was definitely president, you notice the stock market just blew, it just exceeded, expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how many working people can invest in the stock market? That tells you right there.
Jamil, you want to respond?
Yeah, no, I mean, the stock market, as it was looking like he was going to win the election, sunk further than it had since 9/11. And yes, it has rebounded since, but I think it tells you a lot about how, you know, trained financial professionals feel like an untrained person will do in the White House. I mean, yes, you know, Donald Trump has a reputation as a deal maker. He trades on this image as a fruitful businessman, but frankly, a lot of his businesses failed. He's had several bankruptcies. A lot of his hotels and his brands have gone down the tubes. He's gone trial now. It's scheduled for December for fraud in this Trump University gambit that he had, basically defrauding people out of their money promises of this sort of fake education that he was going to provide. It just absolutely staggers me, frankly, that people would buy into a proven con man who's, frankly, not all that good of a con man.
Rod, thanks very much for the call. Carl in Beloit. Hi.
Hi. I have an interesting theory for your guest, and that is I've been trying to wrap my head around the white women vote going with Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can think of is, and I hate to use the term redneck, but you got Tammy Wynette years ago singing Stand By Your Man, and you've got these people in all across the state other than maybe three metropolitan counties, Rock County being one of them, that did go blue, and I may be wrong with the numbers, across the state and across the country. And I think the family dynamics being what they are and the influence of the male and the lack of empowerment by women in all these other counties and all these counties throughout the country are still lacking. They're backwards. And I'm embarrassed to say, when I was growing up, there was a time when my mother would ask my father who to vote for. And that's since changed. She's her own woman. She always was. But she didn't follow politics like my father. And I'm thinking there are still a lot of women out there like that. Or there are a lot of, you know, like I said, rednecks hopping in the back of pickups with their boyfriends or their husbands and whatever, and just regardless of how they really feel, and they may really feel likewise, but they've got this dominant figure who expresses everything on the news in a way that makes it hard not to get pulled in by it.
Yeah. You think there still are a lot of families like that, Jamil?
I want to tread lightly and not speculate on people's family dynamics. That said, I think it is an interesting theory that women may prioritize other things than their own rights and their own, you know, respect that they may be getting from a particular candidate. They may be prioritizing, say, their religion. Abortion rights may take precedence for them. They may feel that, hey, I'm anti-abortion. I'm going to make sure that I vote for the person who I feel like is going to have the best chance of striking down Roe v. Wade, which apparently Donald Trump seems like he wants to do. Maybe they want to vote on other particular issues, and they feel like, hey, you know, maybe they're in coal country, and they feel like his promises to revive the coal industry, which have already turned out to be a lie, maybe his promises to revive the coal industry are going to help my family. That means more to me than whether or not he was caught on tape bragging about sexual assault and saying really offensive things about women.
Yeah, that's another hard one to figure, though, isn't it? Because it does affect everybody, and particularly women.
Yeah.
It's a hard one to figure out what was going on there. And it's another amazing statistic that women, on the whole, voted more for Trump than they did for Clinton.
I mean, I think what we really have a problem, and I think it's what I touched on with that column, before the election, is that for all the empathy that's been shown to Trump voters, that's been showered upon them by the press and by other voters, some of that empathy should have been shown towards groups that were literally put in danger by the election of Donald Trump. We've seen people scared, frightened, not just for their safety, but whether or not they're going to be able to stay in this country, whether or not they're going to be able to have a family, say, you know, gay families who don't know if they're going to be able to adopt under a Donald Trump. All these different rights that all of a sudden are thrown into question. We should not be having this now. We should not be having this, especially after 8 years of this much progress.
Mm. Well, Jamil, I sure do want to thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll join us again, please.
I would love to. Thanks very much.
Jamil. Thank you. Jamil Smith, our guest this hour of the program, and we thank him for all of his time. He was a frequent, you maybe saw him, he was a frequent commentator on TV. We watched, of course, a great deal of, at least I did, way too much cable news for a year and a half as we analyzed this campaign for a year and a half. And he was prominent on television, giving his thoughtful analysis. He is senior national correspondent for MTV News. He hosts a digital series on politics, The Racket. He was a senior editor at The New Republic and producer for MSNBC's Melissa Harris Perry and The Rachel Maddow Show. Tomorrow during this hour, Thomas Frank is going to be joining us. Donald Trump is going to be in the White House, and according to Thomas Frank, liberals put in there. It should be an interesting conversation with Thomas, who is always a provocative guest. He will be with us tomorrow at this time. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios. And next hour of the program, well, let's move off politics for a while. You may have recovered from this loss of daylight saving time. It was sad, wasn't it? Our guests will show the real health consequences for the time shift, and we'll get a history of daylight saving time as well, which is fascinating. That's coming up after the news.